Gray versus United States. Mr. Nichols.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Andrew Nichols for Petitioner Appellant William Gray. This appeal is controlled by this Court's decision en banc in Pruitt v. Moat and later in Hammer v. Ashcroft. Pruitt held that partial consideration by a district judge of an indigent prisoner's request for counsel is an abuse of discretion. Hammer held that perfunctory...
Very unusual, though, to appoint counsel in a post-conviction proceeding. So what's special about this case?
I don't think it is that unusual, Your Honor. For example...
Well, certainly not routine. So what's special about this case?
Well, I think the specific, substantiated, time and place-specific allegations that Petitioner Appellant Gray made to the district court.
Well, be specific.
Sure. Mr. Gray alleged, and the district court didn't even acknowledge in its decision, it didn't mention these allegations. And so Mr. Gray alleged that there were three witnesses against Mr. Gray. No physical evidence came in against Mr. Gray at trial except his jacket for belonging to the motorcycle club, among whom several defendants were on trial. And so the government's case against Mr. Gray consisted entirely of three defendants, and two of them, Mr. Gray said, told him on the bus after trial that they had would recant their testimony. And in this court's decision in Router versus United States, the allegation that comments were made like that merits an investigation and merits an attorney to do the investigation. That was a 3006A CJA case, Judge Posner. And we submit this case is controlled under Router and this court's decision in DeRobertis, which the government doesn't even mention. The government also only mentions Router for the proposition that a CJA petitioner is not constitutionally entitled to counsel. Of course, that's not in dispute in this case. So,
now, wait, are you saying that every time a 2255 or 2254, whatever, the state, any kind of post-conviction proceeding, the petitioner says that a witness has recanted, that he's entitled to appointment of a lawyer?
No.
Okay. This court's decision, that's what it sounded like from what you said.
This court's decision in Farr.
Well, forget the decision. What's your answer? When is it required? When is it not required?
The reasoning of Farr was always like...
Well, just give the answer without the reasoning. Without the reference to a case. That's too complicated. Just give an answer. Just explain.
Okay.
When is it required?
It's required when a petitioner provides the court with, you might say, specific articulable facts, like the court had here.
Well, he just says, someone's promised to recant. Is that enough?
I think that...
If that's all that's required, then every post-conviction petitioner can get a lawyer. Just says, recantation. First person promised to recant.
This court is, pursuant to Pruitt, this court is...
Just answer the question and don't hide behind the cases.
I don't think
Is that where your argument leads, to automatic appointment of counsel in all post-conviction cases?
No, Your Honor. The totality of the circumstances here, as I began by saying, is that there was only a motorcycle jacket in physical evidence against this petitioner. And so what this petitioner has, what the government has, is a very sparse case against the petitioner. And all we have is specific, time and place specific statements about recantation that would knock out two pillars out of three pillars under the government's case. The case can't stand with those two pillars gone. So the cases are always going to be a totality of the circumstances analysis. And in this case, if you have a time and place specific statement about a recantation, then we do submit that there should be an attorney appointed. And I'm sensitive to the court's concern about a number of cases coming along, but I think that can be addressed and should be addressed by understanding the totality of the circumstances and that these are fact-specific cases. Also, if you fast-forward the tape, what happens? Counsel gets a lawyer. We're at the gateway here to habeas proceedings. He's not getting a hearing. This court hears plenty of cases.
Well, how does he propose to investigate this recantation issue?
He would have sent his lawyer have an interview with Mike Collar and John Dernan. That's something you can't do from a jail cell. As this court said in Billman, the reasoning of Billman.
Well, why can't he ask them why can't he write a letter to them and say, you know, promise to recant, and now I need your recantation?
He could attach an affidavit, I suppose, and send a letter to them. He could do that. However, the idea of having someone face to face, an attorney, say, you remember your conversation with Mr. Gray.
Why doesn't he write the letter first and see what these people say, and then there'd be more of a basis for asking for a lawyer?
Well, that's part of the problem here is that Mr. Gray was also denied a stay, and so he spent his time.
In the recantation cases, it's usually not difficult for someone to get another criminal to or witness to recant. As long as that person doesn't face any jeopardy.
And that's exactly the point, Your Honor. The government argues that there would have been a great deal of jeopardy to these witnesses, and so it is a very significant statement that Gray has made that these would recant.
I don't understand. How does a lawyer help?
Again, I believe that the lawyer would be able to go and speak to these individuals directly face to face. Anyone can ignore a letter.
But he didn't write a letter, did he?
He did not write a letter to...
Well, how do we know that it would have been ignored?
I should say that, excuse me.
Well, why shouldn't he, you know, do what he can before he goes to the judge and says, you know, I've done whatever, you know, a prisoner can to conduct investigation. Did my best, didn't work, and now I need a lawyer.
I agree, Your Honor, he should, and he did here. He wrote many letters to obtain his sentencing materials. The problem is that we're asking.
What's the sentencing materials? I thought you wanted a face-to-face interview.
Correct. However, what the court is suggesting is that we ask the pro se litigant to decide which of his theories has the most merit. And he thought that his sentencing.
You're talking about two different things, aren't you? Face-to-face interviews with promised recanters. Now you're talking about sentencing materials. Isn't that separate? A separate issue?
It is separate, and that's meaningful. That matters. The reason it matters is that it shows that Gray did not know how to allocate his time and what he should be pursuing, what was most important. If he had had a lawyer, his lawyer could have said.
What are the sentencing materials?
He had Mr. Gray had a theory that's not before this court about his sentence in this case being in violation of several Supreme Courts.
How the sentencing materials affect the question whether he should have written a letter to these recanters before he asked for a lawyer, or before a decision was made on whether he should have a lawyer?
I think they show how he had decided to allocate his time and how he had decided to what were the most promising leads in the case. He may not have thought at that point that it was going to be the best use of his time to send letters. He may have thought that he couldn't. It's just, with all due respect, the court's assuming he knows that he can send a letter and obtain the proper legal statement from these people that will have binding effect. The assumption in the record from Mr. Gray is that he thought that an attorney was required to have the know-how to obtain that legally binding affidavit or sworn statement. I'd like to reserve a little time for rebuttal, sure, with the court's permission.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Mr. Kores?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Gerald Kores. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Southern District of Indiana, representing the United States in this action. In this case, this Court granted a certificate of appealability on the issue of whether a substantial claim was made that Gray was denied effective assistance of counsel and whether the prosecutor presented perjured testimony during the trial of Mr. Gray. There's absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that any perjured testimony was given, let alone that the government knew perjured testimony was given, nor is there anything in the record to indicate that Mr. Gray did not receive effective assistance of counsel on the issues which related to the witnesses against him, Mr. Hargrove not being mentally competent, and the alleged perjury of the two other witnesses in his trial. Nothing whatsoever. All there is in the record is Mr. Gray's assertion that after trial, and immediately after trial, relatively soon after trial, he ran into one witness who said that he lied, and he and the other witness, who wasn't there, at least according to the statement of Mr. Gray, would recant their testimony if given the opportunity to do so. And separately, that counsel was ineffective for not failing to investigate the alleged mental incompetency of Mr. Hargrove. Those sorts of allegations do not entitle an individual to counsel in a 2255 case, and they don't even state factually, or they don't present factually, a basis for any sort of relief or even an evidentiary hearing. When Mr. Gray had the alleged conversation with Mr. Collar, I believe it was, one would imagine that he would contact his lawyer, say there was this recanted testimony, and ask his lawyer to get on it. He, too, could have pursued it through letters, and the record reflects that Mr. Gray's sister acted for him in various capacities, such as paying for transcripts, contacting court reporters, or he requested court reporters to contact his sister to carry out these activities. There's nothing in the record that indicates that Mr. Gray could not have come up with some evidence that would have advanced his case to the point where perhaps an evidentiary hearing would be required, which then would have required counsel, or that would have given the district court some basis for saying there's a real fact here, there's something to look at. There was really nothing. The same is true with his, with respect to the continuance, which was a subject that the court wanted addressed, and the denials. Judge McKinney refused to stay the proceedings, but he didn't refuse to give Mr. Gray an enlargement of time if Mr. Gray were to ask for one for a specific reason. What Mr. Gray did was he filed a timely 2255, and the record shows with the correspondence he included that he was very cognizant of the statute of limitations on that. He filed it, so he made the statute, and then he immediately asked the court, stay everything because I'd like an investigation or I'd like to do some investigating. And that investigating primarily had to do with the prior convictions. In effect, he was asking to toll the statute of limitations. He didn't have his evidence. He didn't have his material. He wanted the court to say it. The court responded and basically said, no, we won't stay this, but if you need more time to get something, ask. And it wasn't a confusing order. And at that time, he had the period in which the United States had to respond plus the additional period that he had to reply to the United States. He didn't take advantage of that. When he filed his traverse, or his reply, he calls it his traverse, he first asked for counsel. He doesn't do it in a separate motion. He doesn't set forth any of the 1915 elements. He doesn't set forth separately and distinctly any of the 3006 elements. And the court implicitly denies it. The court did not directly address it, but the court went through all the elements of his case, carefully considered it, and that determination clearly indicates that there was no basis for appointing counsel or conducting further proceedings, and the record was adequate to determine the case. There was no error on the district court's part, and the decision of the district court should be affirmed. I waive whatever time I have left.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Correas. Mr. Nichols, well, your time expired. We'll give you a minute. I think his time expired, didn't it? Oh, you have 1 minute. I'm sorry. Time didn't expire.
Thank you, Your Honors. 3 points. Counsel said that the court implicitly denied Gray's request. There is no squaring the district court's opinion in this case with Mr. Gray's traverse. It appears the court didn't read it. Number two, counsel said that there is a problem with the statute of limitations in AEDPA. We've shown on pages 14 and 15 of our brief, none of counsel's cases stand for that proposition. He filed his petition timely. Three, the issue that Judge Posner has raised regarding the policy of allowing counsel to be appointed in these cases is a fair one, and we submit that this is the time. This is not requesting a hearing. We're not ordering a new trial. We're simply requesting and would be calling for an attorney to be appointed to do some investigation. That's a minimal standard. It falls far below the conclusive language of 2255B, and we submit that under 3006A, in this case, and this court's decisions in DeRobertis and Router, the decision below should be reversed.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Mr. Nichols, you were requested to handle the case pro bono. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's on behalf of your client. We thank Mr. Correa.